So, of course, first of all, I have to thank the speaker, the organizers for giving me an opportunity to speak here. But taking into account the day of the week and, well, relative lateness of the hour, I also have to thank the audience for actually giving me the opportunity to present it in front of a fair sample of physics community. So today I'd like to talk about some stuff about entropic laws and the state counting. This is a joint work with et al. Levine that, as many of the works which were presented here, we started at the Perimeter Institute and then we went to our separate continents, to France and Australia, and we kept working on this and other stuff since then. So let me start from the motivation. Actually, motivation is extremely short. It can be summarized in a single line and by a single formula. Let's say from the time of Bekenstein-Hawking, entropy formula through a variety of holographic principles, the idea is very persistent, and indeed this expression summarizes it rather well, that entropy, suitably defined, is bounded by one quarter of the area, suitably defined in suitably defined units. And what we wanted to do is to take a couple of situations which we reasonably well understand, or at least think so, and try to do honest state counting, or at least cheat consciously so we tell when we are cheating, and see whether we get this bound and what it takes us to get this bound. So the outline is extremely simple. I'll review a bit of results about boundary entropy in our approach, and then we'll go directly to bulk entropy, and we'll spend more time actually on bulk entropy and BF theories. This is the work on counting in the loop quantum gravity, which builds on some of our previous results, and the BF stuff hopefully will appear soon. But so let me start indeed from loop quantum gravity. What we are going to do is to consider a spin network and then count the degrees of freedom in the connected finite region of this spin network. We are working kinematically, so we gauge fix and we can think about our spin network as representative of the special diffeomorphism invariant state, but Hamiltonian constraint is not imposed. Then we'll realize that to actually get finite entropy, let alone something which satisfies holographic bound, much more fixing is required. We were able to identify different scaling regimes and, well, had some speculations, but mostly left for future work to connect them with actually imposing Hamiltonian constraint. And to make life simpler, and we spent some time in previous work to explain why it's a legitimate, not a legitimate assumption, but indeed most of the results can be expressed through this simple thing, we assume that all the boundary edges carry one and the same spin 1/2, and we'll see that we'll have a lot of trouble even with this. So, first, let me review our boundary counting, which I think it was by Urich called not black hole model, but black point model. In this case, we have a surface which we imagine to represent horizon of a black hole, which is intersected by, in this case, 2n spin 1/2 boundary edges. And since we assume that it's a black hole, we totally coarse grain the spin network inside. We have no information whatsoever on the interior structure. So what we are left with is a single intertwiner, which is the result of local of the gauge invariance. So basically, counting the number of degrees of freedom in this case reduces to counting the number of intertwiners. We get a closed expression, which has a simple asymptotic formula. Taking into account that in this simple scenario, area is given by a very simple formula. This is your favorite elementary spectrum, L is Planck length. We indeed get entropy proportional to the area. And then we get a logarithmic correction with a prefactor minus 3/2. That's very nice and well, but apart from doubts whether this thing indeed represents a black hole, it's also interesting to see how we get sort of entropic area laws in for more general spin networks. So we either have some information or have reason to not to coarse grain what's inside. The simplest case is if what's inside are just trees, tree diagrams, nothing new happens. We still have the same state counting as for the black point. However, having even a single loop already changes the story. It can be reduced to the form as shown here. So indeed, we have, let's say, 2n spin on half boundary edges stuck as trivalent vertices on a single loop. The labeling of the loop is very much determined by labeling of a single edge which can carry spin j, and then we have just all possible sequences. It's rather straightforward to calculate them. Again, we get some finite number. But then we see that if we sum over with a single loop, we just sum over all initial labelings, we naturally get an infinity. So unless j is fixed, we get infinite results, so not only holography, but no finite number of degrees of freedom. So apart from the obvious desire to get something finite, we can say that we can look at fixing just a single label, just picking up a single representation of SU2 on the loop, as constraining the action of holonomies on this loop. And moreover, when we get this, trying to get the result, which will be actually independent of the labels that internal loop carry and will depend only on their number. So fixing a particular label J, it should satisfy certain conditions that are outlined in the paper, but I skip them here, gives us the dimension of the resulting space, meaning number of states, it's boring asymptotics. We still get the area law with a different logarithmic correction. The situation on previous slide actually also illustrates useful computational aid. It's, while for one loop it's not obvious, for many loops it's much nicer to work with the equivalent picture that you get by choosing a maximal tree and gauge fixing. And going to general case of L loops, again, keeping in mind those three requirements, finiteness, independence of the label, and restricting the action of holonomy, we come up with this decoration of the loop edges, jj, 2j, and so on. This way, the third intertwiner, which I will label C, is just trivial. So the counting becomes rather straightforward. We get the sum, I spare you the asymptotics. What's interesting is to compare two regimes. In any case, the result is independent of the actual label J that we put on the edges. For a small number of edges, we still have the area law with a different type of logarithmic correction. However, in the opposite case, we not only completely lose the area law, we just basically can get whatever we want, just assuming some arbitrary dependence of number of loops on inside the surface on the number of edges that cross this surface. So unless we really have physical reasons to constrain the state, even this extreme fixing is insufficient to recover any sort of holographic bound. So if loop quantum gravity indeed is holographic theory, that more constraints are required and actually imposing the Hamiltonian constraint should severely limit the number of admissible states. On the other hand, with BF theory, where at least for pure BF theory, everything is, solved in quotes, and it's possible to look with explicit the representation of the states, life is both richer and simpler and probably, in a sense, more interesting. So what we're going to do is, again, to count entanglement between interior connected region and the exterior, which, to make calculations simpler, we also consider to be connected. What we can do is, indeed, to get the singular distribution that represents the state after imposition of all the constraints. With our splitting of the system, we can obtain a regularized entanglement, which is von Neumann entropy of the reduced density matrix. we see that it satisfies the area law, and it will be rather strange for something which is a topological theory not to. Still, there are a couple interesting points, and we're able to define renormalized entropy and rigorously prove that with our particular scheme of renormalization, the result is finite, it's cutoff independent. When we admit holonomies along the loops, which in some cases can represent the presence of particles. So having flatness and Gaussian constraints imposed, we end up with some distributional states. And to get our result, it's actually worthwhile to go through a couple of building blocks, which are extremely simple, and, well, graphs are just next to trivial, but actually the same building blocks appear times and again in more complicated constructions. So we have a theta graph here, which I learned just recently, also called a sunset graph. Oh, and probably it's time to apologize a bit. Since I was warned that I have to use only PDF, I stuck into the slide all the stages of the animations that I usually present, so you'll have to see everything at the same time while I'm talking only part of the story. For the Canadians in the audience, you can sort of identify with this progressive conservative style of the presentation, where I use PowerPoint, but do not do the animations. Well, so for this simple theta graph, the least singular distribution is in the first line. We can write it in a symmetric form. The result doesn't change if I work with this expression, which is simpler, just because the second line is equivalent to sticking infinite constant in front of this expression. So we define still formally a reduced density matrix, which is not surprisingly is still distributional. And we just look at the age 3, just for the sake of sort of calculating our basic object. To make sense out of the thing, we need the regularization. So we decompose the delta function in terms of characters of the representation and put a cutoff. Just sum up to some maximal representation. N is a normalization constant. D is a dimension of the representation. And we sum over all integer and half-integer representations. Well, it's possible to get a normalization constant with sum explicitly. The result doesn't matter. The asymptotic dependence is more interesting. But actually, it turns out, if we keep it in the form of delta, we don't need to know anything else. So we're playing a bit with notation, and useful notation, it's sometimes a key to the success or to big part of it. We introduce discrete bases, very similar to one that William was using, and see that our regularized density matrix actually has a form of a maximally mixed state, meaning equal superposition of all diagonal terms which are admissible in our truncated Hilbert space. Its entropy, which for pure states represents the entanglement, or degree of entanglement between our system and our subsystem and the rest of the system, is just logarithm of the dimension. And perhaps I need to say a couple of words about the cutoff. First obvious observation is, of course, I put it there because I want a finite result. Second, if instead of SU2, BF theory actually consider a quantum group deformed SU2, then there is a natural maximal label for the representation, and then this is not a cutoff, but honest counting. And third consideration, which also may be of interest when we consider something which is not that trivial, we know that spins, again, are associated with areas or lenses, depending on your dimensionality. And if we fix a finite area, finite length of our boundary surface, we naturally fix the maximal allowable spin for representation that can be carried by edges that cross the surface. Well, holonomies. Much more fun, much more interesting, and the regularized entropy looks a bit suspicious. So we still stick to this simple sunset graph. We put a non-zero holonomy along, say, the loop of edges 1 and 3, our wave functional just acquires a different form of a delta function, where it's not delta over the group, but delta over the equivalence class of the holonomy. In brackets, just as a reminder, both to you and myself, I put an integral formula that explains its role. Going through essentially the same steps, we have the density matrix with a similar form, but now it's not maximally mixed. So we have squares of characters. Again, we get certain expression for the normalization coefficient. We decompose, we count, we sum, get a closed form. We can do asymptotics with it. We can plug in and get the numbers. Again, I don't want you to bother so far with the results. One observation, this entropy, or this entanglement, if you wish, in the presence of the holonomy is actually smaller than if no holonomies are present. On this picture, I draw the difference, which is negative, for all values of holonomy and the cutoff value of something like 51, or something big enough to get most of the survey a nice flat line with certain spikes, which are not artifacts of numerical calculation, but actually have a very simple simple role and very easily to explain them. So we wish to get rid of the cutoff. So we define the regularized entropy as a limit of the difference. We do the standard minimal subtraction, popular not only in QED, but in, say, many entropic calculations. Difference of the regularized expression in the presence of holonomies and in the absence of the holonomies. It's easy to prove, not easy, but it's provable that indeed this is a honest limit. For irrational values of holonomies, we actually get nice spikes. Those are two of the more prominent. For rational value of this holonomy parameter, we get some further expression. So this is how we can calculate in absence and the presence of holonomies all kinds of entropies for more and more complicated graphs, which is nice. For example, for this in this tetrahedron with holonomy along the bottom face, for that particular decomposition, we get a nice result, which is actually equivalent to what we've got for the sunset graph. However, if this holonomy curve is entirely within the, say, interior region, we get nothing new compared to the case of no holonomies. So I'd like to finish with some speaking about general bounds. And again, the basis to getting those general bounds is in getting good definitions. So let's concentrate on this sort of monster graph, which indeed has edges of three types. Interior vertices connected by the interior edges. Exterior vertices connected by the exterior edges. Boundary edges are shown in bold here. They connect interior and exterior vertices. However, if we want to deal with loops, we have to distinguish between four types of the loops. Interior and exterior are obvious. Boundary loops are those that contain boundary edges and also interior edges. And for the lack of a better word, I use frontier loops to call loops which consist of boundary and exterior or only of the boundary loops. Then entanglement that we are looking for, again, entropy of the reduced density matrix, is between the interior space and the outer space defined by the edges. Then some basic counting tells us a lot of interesting things. So we have total number of vertices, total number of edges, total number of independent loops. That means the minimal number of delta functions that we are putting into our wave functional. We can show that the result is not doesn't depend on the way we pick up the loops after the moment we fix the splitting. However, because of that, we allow to pick the loops that we like to get the easiest way to get our result. And in constructing the wave functional, I pick this number of interior loops, still mimicking the general formula, the number of exterior loops, and complete the rest of the loops by boundary and frontier loops. And their number will be given by number of edges that cross the boundary minus one. Indeed, as a reminder, we still have L delta functions, writing a nice reduced density operator, and going through several steps in the derivation, we are able to identify an important parameter, which is minimal number of boundary loops that involve distinct internal edges, and we can show that this is what enters the regularized entropy. Immediately, from the previous slide of this result, we get an easy upper bound in terms of boundary edges. And this is basically the end of the story for pure BF theory. For example, this glue tetrahedrons and some other junk, with the interior system being those three dotted edges, we do, for all possible decompositions, if you wish, counting of the entropy of this reduced state, twice log delta, which is indeed the number of independent boundary loops that involve distinct edges, as a minute reflection will show, and which is smaller, which is the number of boundary edges, which is 5. I'm probably going to mention what happens if we have holonomies only in one word, if somebody asks. So to summarize, in loop quantum gravity, the gauge fixing is not enough to get a finite number of degrees of freedom or even a holographic bound. So if some sort of holography is valid, we pin our hopes on Hamiltonian constraints. BF theory is holographic, even with non-trivial holonomies, and actually you can put as many non-trivial holonomies in the interior regions and in the exterior regions, it's not going to change this form of entropy. Thank you.
So you identify four types of
Yes.
So can you have those matching of the boundary exterior and
interior? Yeah. Actually, originally I used sort of much more fine classification, which is completely useless. It's just basically you pick up this distinction of types of the loops when you begin to perform the integration to get reduced density matrix edge by edge. And then you see that different types of the loops give different contributions to the resulting reduced density matrix. And whether they do something complicated and non-trivial, that means and they do it only in the case they involve internal edges, but not the internal loops, which are already sort of tensored out, or if it's something which contains only boundary and external edges, then I will get either constant or infinite constant, which I'll drop at the regularization. So this is why insistence on separating between what they call boundary loops and frontier loops. Even at the first sight, all of them should be called boundary and play the role. This is not the case.